Welcome to the Fatal Exception Podcast, where we talk about hard lessons and soft skills for the software engineer's career. We are your hosts, Bill Evanson and Philip Turpin. Let's get started.
I have Angel's Envy, the bourbon whiskey finished in the port wine barrel. Have you ever had that?
One of my favorites. Have. Yeah, I actually like Angel's Envy.
Yeah. The
I'm a big fan of things that are finished in other barrels.
Yeah, it provides another layer of flavors, I guess. But I enjoy the port wine finish. It adds a little sweetness to it, and it's kind of a cool looking bottle as well. And then I have a Dalek ice cube in it. I have one of those silicone molds.
Yeah.
That has the TARDIS.
Yeah.
And the Dalek. And
oh, that's amazing.
And they're fairly chunky ice cubes.
Yeah.
And two of my favorite things, bourbon and sci-fi.
Yes, I do have one geeky silicone mold for an ice cube, and it's a dodecahedron. I think that's what it is. It's the 20-sided dice.
Yeah.
From the time when I used to play D&D, so I have one of those.
Oh, that's fun.
Yeah. Actually, I should probably go to kind of the latest thing. It's a single barrel strength. I think it's a Bell Mead. It's the latest thing I've been drinking. And it's a different flavor profile than I normally drink. I'm kind of branching out just a little bit.
Yeah, I'm gonna have to learn some of the words they use for the different flavors. I'm not that much of a connoisseur. I'm like, yeah, I like that, or I don't. And is it bourbon flavored bourbon?
That's kind of where I have. Like, I have the flavor profile that I really like, but I found something that's really funny is I've purchased several like barrel strength single barrels over the past little bit. Whether that is I purchased a Knob Creek, which I wasn't a really big fan of. I am a huge fan of Elijah Craig's barrel strength, though. I think it's got a really, really good flavor profile. But what I found is, as I go back to non-barrel strength, I'm like, wow, this doesn't have a lot of flavor.
Yeah, it feels very watered down.
Yes, it does. It's really, really funny. And so I need to pace myself, because otherwise, like, you know, I'll start drinking way too much.
Well, so what I do is I'll get a couple bottles of the barrel strength of, you know, whatever it is, and I will kind of limit those, and I'll rotate in some of the others and save some of my favorites for, you know, like Friday night or something. Otherwise, that will turn into a really expensive hobby. All right. So, Philip, so what I wanted to talk about today was this concept of putting in the reps. So what does it take to be a good developer? And I know this isn't exactly a soft skill thing, but I think it's a mindset. And that's where the soft skill comes in. It's a mindset about how you approach your work and how you grow your career and how you get better at software development and how you get better at the soft skills. I think too often maybe we think some of these things are just going to come naturally. And I think about myself as a student in high school especially. I was relatively intelligent, but the laziest student out there. If I had to bring work home, I wouldn't do it. But like, I kind of had this, so many things had come very easily for me early on for the longest time. And I didn't realize this until some contemplation years later, but I just assumed if I didn't immediately get it, I just wasn't going to understand it. It didn't even occur to me that I had to put in some reps. I actually had to like work hard at a thing to really understand it. And so what would happen is I would excel up until the point that it got hard. And then it just drop off, and I would go find something else to do because it just didn't occur to me that I needed to work hard at it. And this started carrying over into my undergrad degree. And in some way, about halfway through my undergrad degree, I started figuring out that there's this companion to intelligence called hard work. And it reminds me of Einstein's quote: "It's not that I'm so smart; it's just that I stay with the problems longer." And it's this lesson that I've been learning as I go through my career, and I continually have to relearn it, that sometimes it's intelligence, but more often than not, it's tenacity. It's just sticking with it. It's putting in the reps. And, you know, oftentimes when I'm talking with developers, it's a sticking point. Like, well, why can't I just, you know, just give me the promotion, or, you know, why don't I have training or whatever it is? And there's a mental block that developers have to get over if they're going to progress in their career. I'm sure you've experienced some of this with your team.
Oh yeah. I think one of the things I heard you say, I think is interesting is you mentioned like tenacity, and you know, I've watched a ton of engineers when they're excited about a thing, they're able to you know, sit down. Like, I know I personally, back when I was coding full time, I could go, you know, plug away 14, 16 hours because I just loved it, right? I loved working through the problem, and it was fun and exciting, and I was really good at it, right? And it was easy to just, like, you know, power through and just, like, really attack the problem and come up and you know, victorious with, you know, the head of the whatever. I think the difference is when it's, when, like you said, it's hard. I mean, funny, like, you know, you hit on my past as well. Like, you know, a lot of things came really, really easy to me, from music to engineering. And it was when it got hard that I would go, maybe I don't want to do that. And I just kind of copped out. And for me, it probably wasn't until my, you know, mid-20s, early-20s, where I started to realize that yeah, like, just you've got to actually do the hard work, put in the reps. And even if it's not necessarily fun at the time, there's a weird satisfaction that comes when you start to master something that's more difficult, you know, than it was when you first encountered it. And it wasn't easy.
What changed for you? How did you, was it just a realization, or did something happen that kind of pushed you into that? Or what made that change for you?
I think for me, it was just, you know, so here we're talking about, you know, going back a couple decades. So, you know, probably early 2000s. You know, I was in a weird situation where, you know, I had a career change, and so I'm leaving systems administration, which was, you know, I had gotten pretty darn good at network engineering. I knew my space, and I was getting into software engineering, and it was hard. And it was much harder. I mean, I had programmed routers and things like that and done some websites, but when you actually get into the engineering discipline, it gets a lot harder. And actually, I love, like, not to go too tangential, but, like, I love the fact that systems administration is, in general, specifically with cloud infrastructure, you know, we're doing infrastructure as code now. And so even our SAs, not only do they have to know how servers should talk to each other, but they're actually having to write code to spin them up. And it's amazing. You know, so for me, it was really just trying to learn that new school, that new craft. I knew I wanted to play in the technology space because I just have always loved technology. But it was hard to master those first few engineering skills. Not like, you know, not to downplay, like, building a website, but building a website wasn't hard. So CSS, HTML wasn't hard. But powering through, like, actually building an application of that the first few times I did that was hard, and just had to power through it. But again, the satisfaction, once you finish it, you're like, whoa, that's amazing.
Oh, for sure. And I think what you're talking about resonates with me. You know, when I first started programming, it was on a TI calculator. I didn't know it was programming, but I just found it super engaging because it was a problem that I was interested in, and it was kind of all new to me. And I was playing. I didn't have a specific goal, so I was kind of wandering through the learning process, which is good. I've learned so much by wandering. But at some point, you have to get into some rigor, I think. It reminds me of a quote I read in, it's not from the book, but I read it in the book, The War of Art. And it's a quote by, William Faulkner. I only write when I'm inspired. Fortunately, I'm inspired at 9 o'clock every morning. Right. And like this concept of, we want the muse to strike. And sometimes the muse doesn't come until we actually put in the work. We want it to be fun, but fun comes after the personal discipline. And that quote really resonates with me as I become more and more of a professional. I'm like, all right, I'm starting my day now, whether I feel like it or not. And I'm going to discipline myself to get to work, to put in the reps. And I'm going to go study the thing, even though that's not necessarily the fun thing. I want to go to, and, you know, as you learn a bunch of things, there are certain things that you know really well. And that's just going to be your easy default thing that, like, well, I'm always going to do the thing that I know. And there's this other hard stuff that I don't really want to think about. For me, I started running into these situations at the office where I was developing some software, and I'd be trying to focus on some problem, and my mind would just kind of skitter off it. And, like, I would want to go do something that I knew really well. And I would find, like, I would literally get tired as soon as I was confronted with this problem that I had no idea how to face. You know, if I knew where I was going, I'd be invigorated, but there was this, this actual physiological response to being confronted with new things. And after a while, I started noticing it, and I realized that I was going to have to change my way about how I learned software development, you know?
Yeah, it's funny. As we're sitting here talking, I'm reminded of an old speech by Art Williams. He gave this speech. He's given it several times since then, but, like, this is just to his speech. He gave it back in, like, 1988 for the Religious Broadcasters Association. It's just really, really good. But a couple things that are in there, you know, I think that one of the differences between engineers or really anybody that just excels in their career is, we talk about tenacity, right? You know, a couple of the quotes from that speech I think are amazing is he says, like, almost everybody in America can stay excited for 2 or 3 months. A few people can stay excited for 2 or 3 years, but a winner will stay excited for 30 years or however long it takes to win. And another quote that just really, like, resonates with me specifically is he goes into this little almost everybody piece. You know, he goes, I want you to know almost everybody in America almost does enough to win. They almost get there. They're almost over the hump. They almost have it going. They almost, in everything they do, almost as a way of life to almost everybody. But the winners do it. And I think, like, that, just that principle of, like, if you give up, I mean, Seth Godin talks about it in business where you reach a dip, right? And you gotta work through the dip. Of course, you also have to have a little bit of awareness on, is this something that I'm not going to come out of? But, like, there's always this pain point where if you can just work through the pain, happens in running when you're running a marathon. Like, if you give up and you don't power through, you may never even realize that you actually love it. Right. And so, like, I think that's just, like, that principle, like, you can be like everyone else. You can be like almost everybody else, or you can try a little bit harder and just really have the tenacity to learn the thing and carry it forward.
You know, my a couple of the things my dad ingrained in me from an early age, he had these two things he would always say, completely corny, but, like, man, they stick with me. And anytime I'd complain about how hard something was, he's like, well, chew on it like a dog does a bone. And like, he'd say this all the time. And then he'd also say, when the going gets tough, the tough get going. And he'd kind of say it like that. And he doesn't have a raspy voice, but he'd just kind of say it like that. And sometimes he'd just be like, stop whining, boy. And this is my dad, you know, and he really exemplified it in so many ways. He didn't let things get in his way. I remember he had like appendicitis or something like that, or like a gallbladder stone or something very, very painful. And he was working on finishing this wall in the bathroom, and he really needed to go to the hospital, but he wasn't going to go until he finished this job. And he was literally laying on his side with the spackle thing, like finishing the wall and just kind of groaning, trying to get this job done. And, you know, I remember him, like, mowing the lawn at like 11 p.m. you know, with a flashlight, because he wasn't going to stop until the work was done. And kind of this sense of tenacity of, like, I'm not going to give in until this thing is done. Like, who's going to win, me or the situation? And I'm convinced intelligence is not the primary attribute of a really good software developer. It's probably two things. One is curiosity, like, how does the world work? Then two is tenacity, is I'm going to stick with this thing until I figure it out. I'm not going to let go until I figure it out. And whatever that means, you know, it doesn't mean you have to work the night, but sometimes it does, not because someone's making you, but because you're not going to let the situation beat you.
Yeah. And there's a flip side of that coin that I find it interesting, because I almost always get one of those developers on my team at some point in time when I'm bringing in new guys. It's the guy that won't ask for help. So, like, to be clear, tenacity is super important, and I want you to struggle and learn new stuff and really get in there and, like you say, chew on the bone like a dog. And you also have to have the self-awareness to know, you know, maybe I could ask for a little bit of help or a little bit of a hint over here, and someone can just, you know, take 3 hours off of my struggle, but I still have to work hard to get it done. So I think that there's this fine balance that I think really good software engineers eventually get to the point where they can say, nah, man, I know that the timeline on this is super important. So I'm going to struggle for 30 minutes, but then I'm going to come up for air and ask for help. Like,
well, and you're absolutely right. And there's a balance there of not giving up and being humble enough to go ask for help. And I think we talked about that previously, but, you know, there's these two really clear moments in my career where that really stand out to me, that were pivotal for me. One was on the help side that you're talking about, where I realized that I wasn't asking for help because of, like, pride. I was like, I felt like I should know the thing. And I had this moment of clarity where I realized that nobody cared if I knew it or not. And right. And, like, I wasn't helping anybody. I wasn't helping myself by sitting there. And I'm like, from that moment on, I'm like, that's it. I'm going to put in the time. I'm going to do due diligence and, you know, I'm going to spend a couple hours on this. And if I don't figure it out, I'm going to go find someone and see if they know. You know, like, I'm not going to just immediately stop and go ask for help, but but I'm going to ask for help. And that's made a huge difference in my career. And the other one, to the tenacity thing, at this very clear moment where I was sitting there working on a problem, and this little voice in my head said, this is the problem that you're not going to figure out. This is the one that's going to prove that you're not a software developer, that you're not good at this job. And I had this moment of clarity. I was like, wait a second. Every time I've kind of heard this little voice and I stuck with it, I figured it out. And, you know, today I hadn't run into the situation that proved I wasn't a software developer somehow. It almost always relied on me displaying some tenacity and just kind of like buckling down and like working through the problem rather than avoiding it, you know?
Yes. I love that.
So if you're talking to a developer, you know, mentoring them or one-on-one or whatever, how would you suggest to them to balance those two? Because they're kind of pulling in opposite directions, right? So one of those is suggesting that you don't give up ever and that you just keep working until you figure it out. The other one is you're asking for help. How do you balance those two?
Well, I think it's funny. I believe that the engineer needs to have the self-awareness or the awareness of their business to know when's the appropriate time to spend a little extra time in the struggle. So let's say if I've got a a critical vulnerability just came up on our scans. I don't want you to thrash on that for hours. I want you to rally around with other people and just dive in because you know you need to solve this problem. You know you need to plug that hole right now, and it needs to be you need to get that over the line quickly. The same thing could go if there's like any sort of hot fix in the system. Those are the moments that you don't want to waste any time in the struggle. Otherwise, but if you're working through a standard new feature that you're building, you know, spend an hour, spend 2 hours in the struggle, feeling the problem and feeling your way around the problem, and then come up for air if you're really just not getting it, right? Come up for air, ask someone next to you to help you point in the right direction. Your goal with that conversation, by the way, shouldn't be to have them answer the problem for you, but maybe just give you a pointer. That's really the balancing act, understanding the problem that you're working on. Is it, do I need a fast turnaround or do I not? Are we coming up against a deadline? Because even if it's not like a critical failure, but you're coming up against a deadline even, right? Like if I don't
ship, understanding the circumstances.
Yeah. And if you have that a little bit of that awareness, it allows you to say, yeah, I'm going to spend some more time right here living through the problem because, you know, I've got a guy on my team right now who, you know, struggles a little bit with designing ahead of time. One of the things we're forcing and providing some extra space for is for him to flex the muscle of, you know, pre-design. And it's okay if it takes you a little bit longer. It's okay, right? But this is just like the awareness of like, there's nothing mission critical we're working on right now. Now, by the way, if something big and hairy comes through that has to be delivered tomorrow, you better believe, go ahead and, you know, roll forward like you normally do because he's a very competent developer.
Well, I think there's something too about how informed are you when you're coming to ask for help. You know, I remember in the early days of Stack Overflow, I was listening to Spolsky and Atwood. They had a podcast as they were walking through standing up Stack Overflow and the decisions they were making. And one of the things that they continually pointed out was if you're going to come ask a question on Stack Overflow, what you need to do first is be able to describe the problem clearly. And explain the things you've tried and the things, and be really clear about the specific thing that you're asking for, right? So it's one thing to come to someone else and say, I'm stuck, help me. And another thing to say, I'm stuck, here's where I'm stuck, here's how the system is constructed. So some boxes and arrows, here's how things fit together. And here's what I've tried, and being really systematic about how you've approached the problem, because that gives the person helping you, it says, oh, this person asking me for help, they're not just deferring the responsibility, they've actually put in the effort, and it gives them context into what the problem is.
Yeah, I love that. I think that's a really, really good point. It is you this is a little bit tangential to the things we're talking about, but I think it is a good awareness of how best to ask for help. It's really to put forth enough effort on your own where you've really tried to solve this problem. Like you've tried and you can clearly articulate why the work you're doing is important. What have you tried so far? Like, I think back, man, I'm going to date myself and go back to the early 90s.
Because you're an old guy.
Okay. Used to do tech support in the early 90s. And, you know, when people would call in and you could tell the people that had tried some things versus the people that hadn't tried anything. And, you know, and it was a moment where I knew what type of call I was about to have when I'm trying to help the people on the other line. Cause that was always my goal. My goal was always to get the people connected as fast as I possibly could so that, you know, they can get our good or service. But it was always like, man, okay, you haven't tried a thing. Let's get started. You know, I used to work for an internet service provider. And so like, oh yeah, it looks like you just got our CD in the mail versus
right.
I've already started, restarted, I've rebooted, I've tried these things.
Yep.
But I'm still not able to connect.
Well, and you're going to be a lot more likely to help someone that's tried to help themselves, right?
Oh, yeah.
Put in the effort. Like, even if it's your job to help, like, it's just, that's how our brains work. We want to help people that are not expecting us to carry them the entire way. And to be clear, like, everybody needs help. You know, I've been doing this for a long time, and it's not like I've somehow achieved some masterhood of this craft. Like, every day there's a brand new thing that I don't know. And I fortunately crossed that threshold where I'm not ashamed to say I don't understand this, because I realize most things I don't understand, and I've been much more willing to go ask for help on that.
You know, not to belabor the ask for help part, but one of the things that I enjoy doing in a interview cycle is get someone to the point where they say, I don't know. Because if you can get someone to the point where they're not BSing anymore, and they actually have that little bit of humility to say, no, I really don't know the answer to that. Not only does it help me know how deep does their knowledge go on a particular subject, but it also, you know, lets me know, are they willing to ask for help? Because if you're willing to ask for help, that means you're coachable. It means all kinds of things that allow me to make a better decision when I hire you.
Yep. Yeah, that's for sure. So let's dig in. So we have some minutes. Yep. One of the frequent questions I've gotten from developers through the years was something along the lines of, why aren't you paying for my training? And to be clear, we've always had some sort of like training opportunity or whatever, but I have a very specific response to that, but you're laughing. So when you hear that, what comes to mind?
Well, it's like, why aren't you paying for my training? Well, I'm happy to pay for your training as long as your training is bringing something back of value to my organization. I will send people to conferences. I will do all kinds of stuff to make sure that they are constantly able to learn new things. But I think I know what you're going to say is like, well, what are you doing to self-learn? Right? You know, what are you listening to right now? What are you reading right now? What are you listening to right now? What are you studying on your own to get better at your craft?
Yeah, that's exactly right. I'm not going to go put, so listen, as a leader, even though you're the leader of individuals, you still have a reputation to maintain with your peers and with your leaders and your managers. And I'm not going to go put my neck out to go spend money on your behalf if I don't think you're going to take advantage of that, because I've seen that so many times where resources were provided, whether it was subscriptions to Safari books or online training, like Treehouse or Coursera or something like that, where we're like, okay, fine, but let's buy a group subscription. And you go back in and look, and no one has actually taken advantage of the videos you've already paid for. And so we just spent a bunch of money and nobody used it. But people kept saying, well, why aren't you paying for training? And maybe I'm being cynical here, and I try not to be. But I hear that as an excuse for why you're not progressing as a developer. You're waiting for somebody else to tell you what to do, what to learn next. You want someone to hold your hand and walk you through the process. That's not going to happen. We don't have enough time in the day to do that. We're going to encourage you to learn. But man, at some point, that has to be on you. You have to go chase that down. This is investment in you and your career. If you want to succeed in your career, you have to put reps into your career. And that may not always happen during the 9 to 5. You know, there's only so much time in the day. And the best developers I know, they're the ones that they go home and they study it and they spend their lunches studying it. And it doesn't mean that you're spending all of your time studying, but there's an attitude about it, about not waiting for someone to tell you what's next, about chasing it down and being hungry. And to your point about, I'm going to pay for it if you're showing interest. I'm going to be much more likely to go look for budget for you to get additional training if you're already exercising the opportunities that you have. You know, one of the first things I always ask, and this is kind of tongue in cheek, but I'm like, if someone asks me for money for training, I'm like, well, have you finished all the free resources on the web yet? And it's kind of a joke, because it's infinite, but it's also not a joke because it's infinite.
Right.
You know, just this last week, I probably watched through 10 hours of YouTube videos on a particular subject, and I just scratched the surface of what was available to me on it. And I learned a lot out of it, and it cost me nothing but the time put into it. And so this concept of needing some sort of paid resource is a fallacy, and we often use it as a crutch for why we're not chasing down our learning opportunities.
I'd agree. I think that people that, specifically engineers who believe that training should only happen during work hours, I think that's definitely a fallacy. In my career, I mean, like for me personally, I go to conferences, I pay for executive coaching, I do things on my side, I find mentors and take them to coffee and find people that I can ask questions of so that I can get better in my own craft, which my craft I believe is leadership. And so with that in mind, like I'm spending a lot of time, I buy a lot. I mean, I probably read 8 books a month right now. You know, I'm just going through a ton of materials on the subject of leadership so that I can get better, so that I can just be better at what I do. I have, like, I've seen guys use a lot of different strategies. And whether it is, I've seen folks that say, hey, I'm already going to this area, can you buy me tickets for, you know, this conference? And of course, my response is like, absolutely, I'll buy your tickets. Can you come back and do a presentation for the rest of the team on the biggest thing you learned? And then it's like, yes, okay, great. I'm happy to pay for books, for book studies. I'm happy to pay for online courses, provided that they're utilized, right? And the team is utilizing them. But that's going to tell me really quickly, how motivated are you? And, you know, should I give you 8 hours a week during your work week to learn stuff? Not necessarily. But do I mind if occasionally you take a Friday afternoon to learn something? I don't mind that so much. But like it's got to be, you have to have the self-drivers internally to grow. You and I were talking just briefly before when I think about this concept. And like I was just having a conversation a couple of days ago where an engineer who's been with me for a while asked the question. They're like, you know, my first couple annual reviews were, man, you gave me some like really clear action steps and like, hey, here's the ways to go solve these problems or the gaps that I saw in him as an engineer. He goes, but the past couple of years, he's been with me about 5 years. He goes, the past one or two, it's been a little more vague. And so like I walked him through my philosophy, which my philosophy is, man, when you're a junior or you're what we call at our place a dev two, which is one step above junior, I don't expect you to know how to grow. As you get into that dev three, or heaven forbid, as this guy is, he's really approaching a senior engineer, I expect you really to own your own. Like you need to see things as they happen and go, ooh, that didn't go well. What's a better way for me to solve that problem? Or maybe I need help solving this problem. Let's say, you know, if it is a scenario where someone is not communicating well or able to sell their ideas well or get the rest of the team on board with the concept, whatever it is, if you spot that as a growing engineer, this is the soft skill conversation, right? Like this isn't, hey, how do I, you know, what's the best resource for learning Java 11? This is, how do I, you know, better communicate or build trust among my team? Those sorts of conversations are, I need you to bring those to me, and then I can walk you through some principles or help you find books to read or some exercises to run with yourself or some techniques to try to then win in that space. But part of what I think about myself, I have to grow, because here's kind of, I mean, where my head goes with this principle is like, there will come a time where hopefully as an engineer, you're better than me.
Well, just out of necessity, how many hours do you have in the week, Philip? And you're spending a good part of those in like meetings and leadership books. Like by definition, if your team is constantly studying their craft, it's not going to take very much for them to be better than you.
No, it's not. It's absolutely a situation where if they can advance at all, you know, I, other than, you know, a bunch of data work, I haven't written real compiled code in half a decade. And so with that in mind, hopefully you can get better than me really, really quick. Now, do all the engineering principles around architecture and design, et cetera, those are all still valid and in my head. So I can help you walk through those principles. But the syntax of your code, you should get better than me at this. And if there's a modern trend that I've never programmed in before, I mean, thank you, Lambdas and Kinesis streams, right? Like, hopefully you have way more context than I could have by watching some YouTube.
You should be able to teach me.
Yes.
How I can't mentor you on that. I can mentor you on decision-making or problem-solving or those kind of things. But when it comes to the specific technical skills, like, you've outstripped me. You know, like, so you said you haven't compiled code in 10 years or whatever. I have continued to develop software even on my own, like, up through, you know, well, I'm doing it now. And even then, routinely on a daily basis, I would step into a problem with someone on my team, and they're talking to me about some nuance of the framework or language that they're using. And I'm like, I don't know. I've never used Ruby on Rails. I kind of see what it's doing, but you know 1,000% more than I do. Like, you can do so many things that it would take me a month or two to figure it out. And at some point, I know I could. I have the experience. But, like, right now, I can't tell you what you're doing right or wrong. You have to teach yourself. You have to find your own resources on this. And, like, I want to be able, like, I wish I knew all the things. And I wish I could teach you, but I can't. It's a matter of physics. I ran out of hours this week, and I had to make a choice between learning this framework and this other thing I was doing.
It's so true. And you're right on. It's partially my time, but it's also, hopefully, you are becoming more of an expert than I can ever become at a thing. And so you have to be able to continuously self-learn. I personally believe that, you know, one of the things that I think are not our higher education system, but like the elementary school, middle school, and high school educations don't do really well is they don't teach our kids how to learn and to self-learn and to find new things that they can be excited about and then go discover and then pick up just raw skills on that. I think that's probably one of the things that I think is a big problem in our education system. So as a lifelong learner that I've become, that I've learned to appreciate the concepts of picking up new knowledge and then being able to apply it, man, that's, by the way, there's nothing that feels greater than reading something in a book or listening to a podcast or attending some sort of conference and then being able to apply something in a week or two and solidify that learning. And then you go, wow, okay, there's a new tool in my tool chest that I can now go and use.
Oh, I love that process of this thing was a mystery and it was kind of a black box. And I really just doubled down and studied it. And now I understand it. And now I have a new tool in my tool belt. This is also this part of, like, now this thing is a mystery to other people, but, like, I know it, and it's there's something very appealing about that.
Because it's funny, you know. I was joking with some engineers the other day. You know, I have I'm pretty competent in the data space, and I realized the reason why I'm competent in the data space is not because I've got some magical whatever, and I'm just really good at data. It's because, you know, I ended up working with people that was so much smarter than me. At one point in time, I had hired two data scientists to work on my team. And these guys were so insanely smart, just so, and their doctorates and all kinds of stuff, right? You know, I had to level up just to keep up and just to give them the tools they needed to do their jobs better and to make them more effective and actually be worth the money we were paying them. I had to level up. And, like, that mystery, as you talked about, as you mentioned, like, that just having that little mystery in my back pocket has enabled me to excel in other areas and provide value beyond what, you know, some of my peers can.
Well, and that, you know, to that point, the things that I've really learned and excelled at and, you know, often continue to I'll moonlight on different projects and stuff, but there's certain technologies that I just know inside and out because I experimented with them and I poked at them and I asked lots of questions and I interacted with people smarter than me, to your point. And it wasn't like this really regimented, like, college or high school style learning process where you sit down for a lecture and they're like, work through these problems and here's your problem set and go do this. It was exercising the system and trying it out. And that didn't work. And let me try something else. And I found that there's three or four technologies that I know inside and out probably better than 90% of people that work in them because I just spent so much time just experimenting with them and not worrying so much about some sort of curriculum and making sure that I checked off the check boxes. I would find something that I was curious about and I would dig into that. Like, why did that work? And I'd spin it up and try it out, throw it away and spin up another one and And once my curiosity in that area was satisfied, I'd move on to the next. And there's kind of this repetitive investigation. And like no one was telling me, go research, you know, how that routing works. It was these moments of like, oh, that's weird. Let me go look at that. You know, like anytime I was surprised about something, I would go spend a little time investigating that. And there wasn't a training program and I didn't purchase anything. I just kept trying things.
Yeah, it goes back to one of the initial points you were making, the concept of tenacity. But I think like, why did I learn a lot about data? I had two good guys around me that could help me when I was struggling with something. And I was willing to buckle down and learn something that was hard. The value that I've seen from that conversation, from that effort, you know, propelled me forward because I was willing to put in the work.
Yep. And if you ever interview with me, if you're listening and you interview with me, you better have some podcasts you're listening to. You better have some hobby projects you're working on, because those are the first things I look at, because I found a direct correlation between personal interest and personal experimentation and how well that person does in the projects we're working on. It's not the only thing, but man, if you don't have that, I'm for sure not going to hire you. And now, so like one final question on this, and this is a lot of people have a hard time with this, but like, what about personal time? Like if I'm studying all the time, aren't I going to become a very boring individual?
I look at that as an excuse. And here's why I see that as an excuse. I'm not talking that you go spend a part-time job's worth of effort, you know, another 20 hours a week in self-learning. You know, I drive about 35, 40 minutes to work every day. And so what that means to me is like that allows me to listen to books. I listen to a lot of books at 1.5 speed and podcasts at 1.5 speed. I can typically get through 2 podcasts a day on my drive to work and from work, right? So like, that means I get through, I can absorb a lot of information just while passively doing something else. If you do yard work, if you've got a lawn to mow, which I do, you know, you can pop a podcast in or an audiobook in while you're doing something around the house, while you're cleaning or whatever. It doesn't have to be some big active, sitting down at a computer and learning a thing. Now, if you're practicing a new language, then yes, of course, you're just building a hobby project, but like find something that you enjoy. Do you have a group of people that like to go hiking? All right. Well, what type of app would make sense to go build to help your group that likes to go hiking? Or do you have a book club or a Bible study or whatever, right? Doesn't really matter what it is. What could you build that would help you out in your life? Do your kids need a chore tracker? I don't know. You know, that kind of thing really helps to, again, solidify the learnings that you had, or if you're trying to learn a new language.
Man, that is exactly right. And I think, you know, this is very much like financial budgeting, so household budgeting, deciding in advance what's important to you. If you've never done household finance budgeting, the first time you do it, you realize how much money you're wasting. There's so much just slush and slack in your finances that once you tighten it up, you suddenly find, oh, wow, we're spending $500 or $600 a month on eating out. What if we cut back on that? Man, we just freed up $400 a month or whatever it is. That may be a little extreme, but maybe not. And this is something that we're going to get into at some point, Philip, is time budgeting, because it's the same exact thing. You don't realize how much time you spend doing things that aren't very important to you, right? You're making trade-offs without realizing you're making trade-offs. You know, so you end up spending 3 hours in the evening watching sitcoms. And then, look, I'll watch sitcoms. I watch TV, but I'm aware of how much TV I watch. I like video games and games on my phone and games on my Xbox, but I'm aware of how much time I'm spending on that. And if you just take a moment and look back, and I have a whole exercise that I run my developers through on this. If you take a moment and really pay close attention to how much time you're spending on things that you don't even really care about, it just, they happen accidentally, you'll suddenly find lots of time that you didn't know that you had. And I understand some people have very full lives because of other things. Most of us don't. Most of us spend, if you look at the stats, how many hours people spend clicking around on the internet, reading Reddit, reading Imgur, how much time people spend watching pointless TV or playing games. There's a lot of time out there. We just don't do a very good job of using it.
Man, you're so correct. Like I'm always reminded of a conversation specifically had by the president and CEO of Netflix. And when you talk about, like, I like television, but I don't watch a lot of television. So, like, you have to take what I'm about to say with a grain of salt, because I like really meaty stuff. I like heavier stuff. And I'm not one to sit around and watch, you know, 17 hours of sitcoms. The CEO of Netflix was talking about, like, what are they working on right now? Like, where, who are they competing with? And they're not competing with any, they're not competing with Amazon Prime. They're not competing with any other streaming platform like Hulu. They're competing with sleep. They're competing with sleep. What that means is they know that they've already consumed all of your waking hours. If their only competition is sleep, man, what does that say about us? You can dial back those other areas of your life that are, I don't want to call them, because I'm not saying, like, I like video games. I like going to the park with the kids. I like going hiking. I like doing things like that. I like piddling around in my workshop doing woodworking. You know, again, I'm a hardware nerd. If you saw my rig at the house, like, it's, I like gaming.
Right? I've seen it.
Right? I mean, and I also find all this time to do, to me, what matters, which is becoming a better husband, a better father, and a better leader. And that's, I mean, so it's possible. It doesn't take 20 hours a week. It just takes some time, some investment. And what was funny is if you invest an hour a week, let's just say you start small, an hour a week, I bet after your first victory, you'll double or triple that.
Yep, because you just see the value in it. What is the name? I'll have to look this up and maybe I can add it in the show notes. There's this book, Secret of the Small Things, or but the premise of the book is how small things add up. How, and you know, he gives anecdotes of a people that he runs into, and like this one individual had a stack of business books, and every time they, you know, had a free moment, they'd read a little bit. And you know, one page of a book is not going to make a difference, but you know, finding every chance you get, kind of working your way through that book, you know, 15 minutes every morning, 20 minutes every morning, you're going to get through that book, and you're going to get through lots of books. And I remember an anecdote of Bill Gates. He always carried with him a stack of science magazines. It was like Scientific America or something like that. I may be misquoting that. And when he was riding the company shuttle or something, or going from building to building, he would have these and he would read articles from them, and making use of the time in between. And so there's a lot of these moments that we don't take advantage of. I leave it at this. You don't have to do these things, but you're always going to be a marginal player, because you're not going to grow as a person. You're not going to learn. You're not going to be stronger. You're not going to be smarter. And like, I love to compete against someone like that, because I've put in some extra reps. I've put in some extra study. And I'm like, great, man, I'm going to compete against you. I'm going to get the promotion and the pay raise. And that may not feel fair, but man, that's how it is.
Dude, absolutely. I mean, you know, if it's sort of like competing with you for a job, like if we're both applying and I have anecdotes from 15 books that I've read in the past 3 months, and I can bring this up in the interview and just talk about it because it's applicable to the job that I'm applying for, and you don't have that, great, I win.
Yep. Yep. And that may not feel fair, but that's not how the market works, baby.
No, it isn't. And by the way, and I also will, as we've kind of said here, like, you know, Bill, you hold these things up as part of your hiring process. I do the exact same thing. And so as a hiring manager for, you know, I've probably hired, I don't know, a couple hundred people in the past decade. If you're not growing, I'm not interested in you.
I'm not going to push on your behalf. If you're pushing, I'll push with you.
Yes, absolutely.
But if you're not pushing for yourself, at some point, I'm going to push you out the door. We're going to find a way for you to find something else that fulfills you better. And I'll just wrap up with this. Like, look, both of us, it's not like we study all the time. I have a very fulfilling personal life with children and a wife, and we spend lots of quality time together, and we do fun things. And, you know, I watch some TV shows at night with my wife, but I'm just really purposeful about it. Like, what is it that I want, and how much am I willing to sacrifice for that? And if that sacrifice is too high, fine. I'm like, I'm not going to do that. And I've learned over the last couple of years about actually cutting things out, because I went the other way. I added too many things into my life. But you can have a very fulfilling, very happy life with plenty of sleep and still grow in your career by putting in the reps, you know?
That's it for this week. Thanks for listening to the Fatal Exception Podcast. We hope you enjoyed listening as much as we enjoyed talking. If you want to contact us, you can find more information at fatalexceptionpodcast.com, or you can email us at contact@fatalexceptionpodcast.com.